Welcome to The Director's Chair, a Lowy Institute podcast. My name is Michael Fawley-Love and I'm the Executive Director of the Lowy Institute. On The Director's Chair, I sit down with political leaders, policymakers, and commentators in order to understand what's happening in the world. I'm delighted that my guest on this episode of The Director's Chair is a friend of mine, the former US Deputy National Security Advisor, Matt Pottinger. Born and raised in the Boston area, Matt graduated from the University of Massachusetts Amherst with a degree in Chinese studies. He worked as a journalist in China for more than 7 years, first with Reuters and then with the Wall Street Journal. In 2005, Matt left his career in journalism and signed up with the US Marine Corps as a military intelligence officer. He served 3 combat deployments in Iraq and Afghanistan as a US Marine. In 2017, Matt joined the Trump administration, initially as the senior director for Asia at the National Security Council. And he stayed for almost all of President Trump's term in office, serving under 4 national security advisors and ending up as the deputy national security advisor, the first Asia specialist, I believe, to hold that office. He now serves as a distinguished visiting fellow at the Hoover Institution. Thank you very much, Matt Pottinger, for joining me from your home in Utah for the director's chair.
Michael, it's great to be with you. So thanks for having me.
Well, first, Matt, let me ask you about your background. I know your father served in the Nixon and Ford administrations. Tell us a bit about your folks and your upbringing, if you would.
Yeah, so my folks are from Dayton, Ohio. They were high school sweethearts who got married. My father was a football player. He's the quarterback for his high school team. And was planning on playing, big state football when he got a letter from a certain senator who was a Harvard graduate who was working on constituting a decent football program at Harvard University. It was actually Jack Kennedy who recruited my father to play football at Harvard. And so my father played his freshman year and then gave up football and got interested in other things and went to law school there and got involved in mostly in civil rights law and ended up working for health, education, and welfare when that was a thing, its own department. And he worked on civil rights and then became the assistant attorney general at the Department of Justice handling civil rights cases. He handled many of the most contentious and historic cases, everything from desegregating schools. Mm-hmm. He was in the middle of that doing busing, trying to integrate public schools. He was at Wounded Knee. He was at Kent State trying to prosecute soldiers that had opened fire on students there. It was an interesting upbringing. My folks split up when I was just a tiny kid, and my mother moved out west and married my stepfather, who was an Air Force officer. Mm-hmm. And so I had the benefit of having 2 dads. Mm. And so both of them had a huge impact on my life and influenced me in ways that played out over many decades. I mean, my late entry into the military when I was 32 years old, I think was in some way prompted by my upbringing, by my stepfather who had served.
All right. So you had public service through both your dads, as it were. And then early in your career, you got into China. So what first interested you in China? And what did that reporting spell in China? How did that reporting spell in China change your mind about China?
Most of my childhood, all the way through college, was spent in Massachusetts, as you mentioned. And I went to a prep school south of Boston that in the 1980s, it offered Mandarin Chinese as a second language. And I was struggling in my Spanish class and looking for an out. I had a really tough Spanish teacher and I hadn't worked hard enough at beginner Spanish. So this was my escape. I ended up shifting over to Chinese and ended up really loving it. I applied to do an exchange program in Beijing. So it would have been a summer exchange program that my high school was organizing. And the school that I would have been studying at in Beijing was the Second Experimental Middle School, which is just outside of Tiananmen Square. As we got ready to go, I had my passport stamped and, I had flashcards that I was trying to memorize vocabulary as we were getting ready to go. And I think it was the 20th of May, 1989, martial law was declared in the midst of the mass demonstrations that were taking place following the death of Hu Yaobang. Mm. And so they ended up pulling down the trip. But it was really kind of a fateful moment in history, not only, you know, for China and the world, but for me as a young high school student, that's what really got me interested in newspapers. I subscribed to the Boston Globe as a result of the events taking place in Tiananmen Square. And I was following through the photos and the stories in the Boston Globe, what was happening there. And that's what really started to get me interested in current events and in what was going on the other side of the world. It was another 4 years before I finally got to China, but it all influenced me to continue with my Chinese studies when I got into university.
And what did you learn about China when you finally made it there as a reporter? How did it affect your thinking on that country?
Yeah, I was under the impression that China was on an unstoppable streak. You know, even though this was 1993, it was only 4 years after the Tiananmen massacre. The country, you know, forcibly buried that event. You know, Beijing decided to enact some of the reforms that were demanded by the students and workers who were there. You know, people wanted the right to be able to work in the private sector. They wanted to be able to choose what jobs they were going to have as they came out of universities and so forth. This was the moment when they were really shifting toward allowing the private sector to advance. And that was pretty soon before you then had Zhu Rongji come into office a few years later as the premier. He allowed the virtual privatization of property for the first time in the history of the People's Republic of China. All of the reforms just kind of exploded from there. So it was an exciting time. From 1993, when I first got there, until, you know, the end of the 90s, really until China entered the WTO in early 2001, was in many ways the most exciting period to be a young student and then young journalist stomping around from province to province and writing stories about the rise of China, in large part because the government was beginning to get out of people's way. It was beginning to let Chinese people be themselves and be entrepreneurs and, you know, build a life and pursue their dreams.
What about the darker side of life in China, though?
By the time I was working there as a journalist for Reuters and then later for the Wall Street Journal, I certainly had run-ins with, you know, the security apparatus for story, you know, so-called sensitive stories, as they would put it, that I was working on, you know, corruption, religion. I was there for that historic protest, that sit-in protest surrounding the Zhongnanhai compound by, 10,000 or so adherents to the Falun Gong sect. And I think Beijing was deeply rattled by that, and they went quiet. And then a few months later, they came back with one of the most vicious crackdowns of modern times. I mean, they completely obliterated the practice of Falun Gong within China. You know, people were being rounded up into stadiums and sent off to prison for 10 to 13 years. And, you know, there's been a lot that's been written about that period, but it was dark.
In 2005, Matt, you wrote an opinion piece for the Wall Street Journal titled Mightier Than the Pen, where you said that in your early 30s, you were joining the US Marine Corps. Why did you decide to put down the pen and pick up the sword? And what did you learn about yourself and about life serving in the Marines?
I'd been in China for many years when the September 11 attacks occurred. The world was rattled by those attacks. I was in New York the day of the attacks. I was actually on my way down to the Wall Street Journal headquarters to meet with the editors. Mm-hmm. I was visiting from Hong Kong when the planes hit just across the street from the World Financial Center where the paper was. So, you know, I then could not help but start paying attention to events that were going on in the Middle East, the war in Afghanistan, followed by the 2003 invasion of Iraq. And by 2004, when it became clear that the nature of the war that we'd gotten involved in, particularly in Iraq, was not a redux of the Gulf War, which is what it felt like it was going to be, but actually it was the beginning of a major insurgency and the U.S. Having to shift to counterinsurgency operations for the first time since the Vietnam War. And I was very troubled by how badly the war was going. I was troubled by the fact that we had miscalculated the nature of the war. And I was also troubled by the possibilities for what this would mean for American power and influence in the world if we were to lose this war. And so I had sort of a soul-searching moment where I thought it might be time to participate in events and not just observe them and write about them. Mm-hmm. That led to my decision to enroll at Officer Candidate School in Quantico in the fall of 2005.
All right. And you've written about how unfit you were and how you had to sort of drag yourself up to the levels of the US Marine Corps. But what did you learn about yourself? What did you learn about?
By the way, things have come full circle. I'm perfectly unfit again after 4 years in the White House. Talk about the unmaking of a Marine. It was painful.
Yeah.
Raising two little kids and working 7 days a week.
And eating at the Navy mess.
Yeah. I'm trying to get myself back into fighting form again.
But tell us about the experience of serving in combat, serving in Iraq and Afghanistan. What did you learn about yourself? What did you learn about life?
One of the amazing things about the Marine Corps that I learned was that this was a highly undemocratic organization that exists for the purpose of protecting democracy. And so that paradox was always present. But of course, you can't run a military organization as a democracy. It doesn't work. The Marine Corps has done pretty well over the decades and centuries as a warfighting organization. It's a very proud and effective organization. One of the things that really struck me in sort of the ethos of the Marine Corps is that it doesn't focus on the people at the top of the organization. It doesn't focus on those who have done the best and giving ever greater opportunities to the creme de la creme. It doesn't even focus on officers as the heart of the organization. The heart of the organization are enlisted Marines and junior enlisted Marines. And so the idea of the Marine Corps is that the entire organization does well because it focuses on pulling people at the bottom up to a pretty good standard. It doesn't focus on taking, well, let's see who does extra well and let's keep separating them out and promoting them higher and creating little sub-compartments and separate mini services within the service. That's not the Marine Corps. The Marine Corps basically says a Lance Corporal, certainly a corporal, is capable of leading a squad of Marines and is expected to take charge and to be delegated the authority to do that because there's trust that he or she's been trained to an extremely high standard at the bottom of the organization. That's like the opposite of everything else in American life, by the way. You know, so there were things that I love about Marine Corps culture that I wish would be promoted in the broader society. The idea of pulling people at the bottom up to a level of competence and pride and trust is a way to make an organization, including, I think you could make a country work better if you were applying those same sorts of precepts.
All right, Matt, in 2017, you were asked by your former commander in Afghanistan, General Michael Flynn, to join the Trump administration as the senior director for Asia on the National Security Council. What was running through your mind when you took on that job? You said earlier to me you wanted to be a participant. Did you have any reservations when you took on that job?
Yeah, you know, I received that call after the election of 2016. I did some soul searching again. I consulted a couple of important mentors in my life and was strongly encouraged to go in and contribute however I could. So I ended up coming in on the first day of the Trump administration on inauguration day, January 2017. And, you know, this was a difficult period in our country's history. And it was also a difficult period in our foreign policy, and specifically a really sort of a moment of reckoning. In my view, it needed to be a moment of reckoning for our longstanding policy vis-a-vis China. And so I got to work coordinating our policy and helping support the president in his diplomacy with Prime Minister Abe right out of the starting gate. He invited Prime Minister Abe to come visit Mar-a-Lago. And not more than several weeks after that, he had Xi Jinping coming as well. And so you had this untested president who had never had any political experience in his life tackling some of the most consequential issues right out of the starting gate. I think that in spite of all the headlines and so forth, if you look back at particularly that year of 2017, the amount of change that was induced in our administration on foreign policy, on policy towards Asia, policy towards China and specifically, we ended up drafting and producing a national security strategy in the first year that he was in office, which is extremely unusual for an American presidency. Our Indo-Pacific strategic framework, which was a since declassified but then secret strategy, was written in tandem. And our national defense strategy was written in tandem as well. And all of those strategies were mutually coordinated and reinforcing and marked a paradigm shift in our relationship with the People's Republic of China.
Matt, you played a critical role in the formulation of the Trump administration's policy on China. Can I ask you, though, about the president's own views on China? Because it certainly seemed to me from a distance that there was a dualism to his approach to China. He seemed to oscillate between being tough on Xi Jinping, but at the same time believing that he could make a very special deal with Xi Jinping. His policy got tougher as the election approached, but especially in those first couple of years, isn't it fair to say that there was a sort of a bipolarity to his own approach to China?
No doubt that he, like many senior officials and presidents and others over time, believed that personal diplomacy could compensate for structural problems in a relationship and fundamental differences between the nature of our two governments. And so President Trump wanted to test that proposition. He was not an unconfident man. He wanted to try to test his ability to persuade Xi Jinping to, in his words, stop taking advantage of the United States. And so I think over the course of 2017 was really the height of testing that approach. He met with Xi Jinping, I think, three times in 2017, if I remember correctly, met in Mar-a-Lago, met again at the G20, and then made the trip to Beijing in November of 2017 for the State Visit Plus, as the Chinese were billing it. And that's really what it was. The personal diplomacy remained a feature of his approach the entire time that he was in office, but he wasn't going to leave it entirely to diplomacy as opposed to imposing costs. And that's what you saw as 2018 rolled into view. You saw President Trump impose unprecedented tariffs. People often forget that the tariffs that he imposed at first were rather targeted. It was, I want to say it was about $35 billion worth of tariffs. So well below 10% of China's exports to the United States that were represented. And they were targeted for, you know, goods and services that had benefited, clearly had benefited from the theft of American intellectual property or from the forced transfer, which is really another form of theft of American technology. And Beijing calculated that if they retaliated hard, that President Trump would do what other presidents had done and back down. But of course, that's not what he did. He came back at him twice as hard. And by the end of it, we were, you know, in the hundreds of billions of dollars worth of goods that were being tariffed. To the spirit of your question about this duality or bipolarity in the approach, Americans are pretty good at improvising. And I think we improvised a foreign policy that took into account both features of the approach. President Trump's keeping Xi Jinping close in the sense that he was talking to him regularly in person and on the phone, writing letters, but also below the level of the president, he was permitting us to start taking unprecedented tough measures designed to impose costs on China's theft of our intellectual property, on its attempts to take control of the South China Sea, and so on.
You mentioned earlier some of the foreign policy decisions that you're proud of from your time in the White House. What were the foreign policy decisions or statements by President Trump that you felt uncomfortable about? Did you feel a lot of the time that you were on defense and trying to prevent President Trump from doing things with which you disagreed?
There were things that I advised against or that others advised against that he went ahead and did. And sometimes those things turned out to be more effective than what we were advising. We have to be humble to realize that sometimes a highly unorthodox approach actually ends up working in ways that advisors or members of the establishment and commentators don't expect. And I can talk a little bit about that in some examples of that. But I do want to dispel the idea that, you know, our job or my job was to resist the duly elected president of the United States. I mean, our Constitution is very clear on who makes foreign policy in the United States. It's the president downward. It doesn't come from Congress. It doesn't come from National Security Council officials. It doesn't come from the editorial page of the New York Times. We were very conscientious about giving the president our best advice, giving him multiple options and not trying to box him into one outcome. And in that sense, I think over time, as more archives are opened, people will see that all four national security advisors and the members of the national security staff lived up to varying degrees, but really did live up to that approach.
Tell us a bit about President Trump's relationship with Australia, Matt. We all remember that first phone call with Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull that was reported on.
I'm sure Prime Minister Turnbull remembers it well as too.
Were you on that call?
I was.
You're happy with that one?
I was on the sofa in the Oval Office with the president.
You were lying down on the sofa at that point?
If there had been fewer people sitting on the sofa, I would have laid down and put a cold compress on my forehead. But look, this was President Trump's unique style. He came at Prime Minister Turnbull hard on a sensitive domestic issue for both of our countries, which is illegal immigration. And in the end, they ended up having quite a good working relationship. I thought we were able to get an incredible amount done together with Australia over the 4 years that we were in office. The next time President Trump saw him, they got along swimmingly. He did with Prime Minister Morrison afterwards as well. The idea of reframing Australian and American foreign policy in that region as an Indo-Pacific foreign policy, that concept of accentuating different aspects of how we look at the region was something that we did together. And it was something that both sides contributed to from the president on down, and certainly in a lot of private consultations that I had with Australian counterparts over those years. I mean, I can't think of a closer relationship. I mean, I worked extremely closely with Japan, and I worked extremely closely with Australia. Those were among some of the most rewarding sort of working relationships that I had at my time at the NSC.
Let me ask you about Australia and China. As you know, after Australia called for an inquiry into the origins of the coronavirus pandemic, China responded to this and other supposed provocations by imposing sanctions on our exports, including barley and wine and coal and many other products.
Lobster.
All the good stuff. Yep. You wrote recently, Australia is a guinea pig on which Beijing is experimenting with Xi's new strategy of offensive decoupling. And you said Australia's travails, which continue today, are a foretaste of what Beijing has in store for the rest of the world. Can you expand on that a bit?
Yeah. So if we look at what Beijing's stated policy is, and it is in black and white now, it's in writing. It was institutionalized first in a couple of speeches that Xi Jinping gave last year, and then in the 14th five-year plan that the Communist Party institutionalized just a few months ago. The stated economic policy is to decouple on Beijing's terms. They don't use the term decouple, but if you read it, that's really what it's about. It's about making sure that Beijing no longer depends on high-tech imports. As quickly as it can make itself independent of other industrialized nations for high-tech goods, it will make itself self-sufficient. And at the same time, Xi Jinping stated this explicitly, he wants to make sure that the rest of the world becomes increasingly dependent on China for their high-tech supply chains. Another feature of their strategy is to make countries like Australia increasingly dependent on China as an export market for non-high-tech goods, you know, really more for raw materials, obviously iron ore and many of the things that you just mentioned, beef and barley and seafood and the like. And then to use that leverage, the leverage that they acquire for what Xi Jinping euphemistically calls deterrent purposes. But what he's really doing is not trying to deter. He's using offensively the leverage that China accumulates in order to try to advance Beijing's political goals. And that's exactly what you saw play out over the past year vis-a-vis Australia. But Beijing was annoyed that Australia had made the perfectly reasonable suggestion that the world try to figure out where COVID originated. Almost every member of the World Health Organization agreed that that was a good idea, except for China. And China decided to start punishing Australia by cutting off those Australian exports, and then made this extraordinary set of demands. It was called the 14 disputes that the Chinese embassy put forward, which were really just demands, and they were mainly political in nature. Beijing was asking Australia, was saying, look, if you want the relationship to improve, you need to muzzle your free press and have them stop criticizing the Chinese Communist Party. You need to change your laws that you've passed that are designed to prevent corruption and malign influence by China in your domestic politics. So this was wholly unacceptable. So yeah, Australia was a guinea pig. The good news is the guinea pig not only survived, but the science experiment really went wrong for Beijing. And I think that Australia, we look a year later at Australia's situation, and I think it illustrates that Beijing's attempt to coerce has backfired. Beijing had really gambled that Australian businesses We're going to lobby their government to make political concessions to Beijing. But the Australian people, including exporters, including business leaders, understood that if they accepted this ultimatum from Beijing, it was a political ultimatum, it would mean that Australia would have submitted really to a dangerous new order. So Australia ate the losses, weathered the embargo, and has had success, by the way, finding new markets as substitutes for China. So Beijing's not going to be able to play this card again. They've played it against Australia. It backfired, and now they can't play it again because Australia is now diversifying its export market. The wine industry is the one that has had the most trouble. So we're my wife and I are doing our mm-hmm. duty and solidarity with the Australian people and vineyards, and we're buying Australian wine this summer.
Well, thank you for that. Let me ask you about solidarity, if I can. We saw a lot of positive statements at the G7 and NATO meetings, but not too much action on China. And indeed, some of our friends seem to be taking advantage of Chinese sanctions on Australia to expand their market share. So let me ask you, what is the likelihood of meaningful solidarity between Western countries in the medium and long term, given the magnetic power of the Chinese economy? Because countries are cold monsters in the end. To what extent will this hope that the Biden administration obviously has that the democracies will stick together and show solidarity to themselves? What are the chances of this working, do you think?
You know, President Biden's approach has been heartening. One of his key deputies at the National Security Council staff, Kurt Campbell, has stated, I think twice on the record, that the United States is not going to improve its relations with Beijing until Beijing improves its relations with Australia. That's the right spirit. There are ways to do that discursively and in an ad hoc manner like we're doing right now, but there might also be ways to formalize some kind of a mechanism that, look, I think over the long term, the way forward is for countries that enjoy the rule of law to actually expand trade with one another and diversify their supply chains toward each other's economies and to become less reliant on a totalitarian dictatorship that does not mean any of us well. And so it's an aberration in history that you would see so much of the world's manufacturing base concentrated in one country, and even more of an aberration that that country should be a Leninist, mercantilist dictatorship. Okay. It's not going to be good for business over the long run. And I think that you're already seeing some structural changes. One of the salutary effects of President Trump's tariffs, by the way, that don't get remarked on often enough, are that it did create a logic and some momentum for moving manufacturing and foreign direct investment to other economies, not just to China. We've seen that happen. China's still drawing a lot of investment, but now so are countries like Vietnam, Mexico, some manufacturing's moving back to the United States as well. It needs to diversify. And there are ways to do that, you know, in coordinated fashion among G7 members and among the quadrilateral allies as well.
Speaking of the Quad, what did you think of President Biden's decision to convene the first meeting of the Quad leaders?
We were thrilled. I mean, we spent a lot of hard work over the course of the Trump administration trying to develop the Quad. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo did the first two cabinet-level meetings of the Quad ever. I actually maintained a regular Deputy National Security Advisor Quad video conference, which we weren't public about, but it was quite substantive. We got a lot of work done sort of setting an agenda for the Quad. And it touches on many of the themes that you and I are talking about right now. We talked a lot about supply chain diversification. We talked about pushing back against disinformation and malign influence activities. And for President Biden to come in and for his team to pick up that ball and run with it as quickly as they did was really great work. They had the first ever summit among the quadrilateral nations, and I hope they do more of them.
All right, let me come to COVID, Matt. Last week, I interviewed the staff writer for The New Yorker, the storied nonfiction author Larry Wright, about his new book, The Plague Year, in which you star. And Larry described you to me as a one-stop journalistic shop when it came to COVID, because you'd covered the SARS outbreak in China. Your wife, Yen, works for the Centers for Disease Control, I believe. Your brother, Paul, is a professor of infectious diseases. And of course, you served at the White House during the plague year. I'm tempted to ask who you would like to play you in the film adaptation of Larry's book, but perhaps I'll ask you instead what it's like being the star of a book like that. What did you think of the way he portrayed your sort of a one-man war against the virus from within the heart of the Trump administration?
Well, I want to be played by Samuel L. Jackson. No question about it.
I thought you might have gone for Gary Sinise.
I love Gary Sinise too. Gary Sinise, by the way, was someone who, you know, over the course of his whole career has been really supportive of American troops. And that's something I'm always grateful for. He'd show up in Iraq and, you know, at least all these wild places. But the year 2020 is one of the worst years that, you know, hopefully we don't have a worse one anytime soon. My wife got me a t-shirt. Remember the old movie Back to the Future? Mm-hmm. It's a picture of the DeLorean car from Back to the Future. And it says, Marty, whatever you do, don't go back to 2020. So that's pretty much how I feel about 2020 and the plague that we've been fighting and are continuing to have to try to outwit, given that it's mutating into new variants and so forth. But yeah, I'll have to listen to your podcast with Larry Wright.
Let me ask you, America got a lot wrong last year in the response to COVID. And President Trump has come in for a lot of criticism for the way he conducted himself. How much do you think what happened last year was a result of his particular approach to his office versus deeper frailties in the American system?
It's going to take a long time for people to really look dispassionately at such an emotional year and at the response to COVID, myself included. You know, what I would say is that as people start to approach looking at it with a more historical eye, and also with an eye toward making reforms that will actually make a difference, I think that people need to start looking not only at the political response, which you know, had its ups and downs, but we've also got to look at the institutional response, which I think was woefully inadequate. And some of those are not because we have bad people in government. It's more that if you look at some of the failures, like the failure in testing, diagnostics, mm-hmm. at the Centers for Disease Control, if the CDC had been oriented toward a much more natural partnership with private industry, for example, they might have avoided that. They tried to do it themselves rather than scale up testing very, very quickly, work with big firms that could actually run significant production lines. If you look at how the playbook that we threw at it turned out to be the wrong playbook. This was not influenza. We were preparing for a bad flu. Mm. And the only thing that this really held in common with flu is that it's a respiratory virus. But the other features of this virus, the fact, for example, that it spreads asymptomatically, render the flu playbook wholly inappropriate to this disease. It means that the diagnostic approach is different. You know, most people who get flu don't get tested for flu. They get diagnosed with flu based on the symptoms. You can't diagnose based on the symptoms for 50% of the people who get COVID asymptomatically. Mm. So that was the wrong approach. That screwed up our first measures, like doing temperature screening. That didn't help at all. Mm. Our assumption that we could handle the diagnostics, that didn't work. Our assumption that we didn't need masks because we don't use masks for influenza season, when in fact masks were the one cheap, reasonably available option that we had to try to mitigate the spread of this thing. So some of those were political decisions, but a lot of them were based on the advice of real experts, and the experts got it wrong. So I think that you've got to look at the institutional failings as well as the political mistakes. If I were to look at the things that we got right at a political level, President Trump's decision to shut down travel, first with China and then later with Europe, were very difficult, bold steps that I think did save lives. And most of all, the Operation Warp Speed. Operation Warp Speed was not the natural inclination of public health experts either. They wanted to go with sort of tried and true vaccine development methods, like using a attenuated virus, you know, which was the approach that AstraZeneca, the Oxford vaccine, went. I think there was a lot of suspicion among public health experts about going with mRNA, you know, the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines when those were unproven in their mind. And yet the decision was made at a political level to try to develop as many vaccines as possible, as quickly as possible, and to back many horses, not just put it all on what, you know, one or two experts thought would be the right ones. You know, no other country really did it but the United States. And it resulted in these dark horse vaccine candidates being the most effective ones of all, the Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna vaccines.
Of course, we're seeing new variants, and so far the mRNA vaccines are effective against those variants. But what do you think the virus, which is a very canny enemy, what do you think it's got in store for us in the future?
Yeah, my wife is a virologist who worked in the labs at CDC for many years. She's really an expert on HIV, but she's been doing a lot of work on COVID, like every virologist over the last 18 months. She is watching very closely the uptick that's occurring right now in cases in a number of countries, including the UK, including the United States. And she's keeping an eye on the potential for what's called viral escape, meaning the virus makes enough mutations that it's able to escape our existing immunity and the effectiveness of our vaccines. It looks like the virus is making some progress in escaping, but what we know is that the vaccines go a very long way toward reducing infection and also reducing the severity of the disease, but it's not a magic bullet. It worked extremely well against the early variants. It's working less well against this new Delta variant and what's being called Delta Plus. You know, it sounds like a frequent flyer program or something, but it's definitely not that. So I am concerned that we're going to be struggling and wrestling with this virus for many, many years to come.
Matt, you served for almost all of the Trump administration, but you left a little bit early. After the 6th of January siege of the Capitol, you resigned from the Trump administration. Why did you decide to resign?
Yeah, you know, I think the events of that day, January 6th, were for me a red line. Decided that it was time to go, and I resigned that afternoon. Mm-hmm. I stayed at my post for many more hours to make sure that I could leave responsibly. There were a lot of dangerous things going on in the world. I wanted to make sure that the National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien would not be left in the lurch, and that we would have the ability to continue staffing the president and keeping an eye on some of the most dangerous developments around the world. But that was, for me, the moment that I had to go.
Matt, do you ever miss working at the White House?
I've been out for, you know, almost half a year now. I'm really happy to not have the weight of the world on my shoulders. I'm happy to be able to share meals with my children again and to be able to put them to bed at night. I'm very much enjoying having a life again and more time with my wife and with my children. I do not miss it. I'm proud of all the work I did there. I'm proud of a lot of things that the administration did. And I think I'll look back on those years as ones that I'm proud of. But right now I'm quite happy to be out of Washington, D.C.
And what's next for you, Matt? I know you've moved to the heartland, you've moved to Utah. Would you consider going back into public service in the future?
You know, no plans to do that. I'm still engaged on policy issues, mostly through writing and podcasts like this one and, you know, testifying to Congress and providing any help and support that I can to colleagues in Congress and in the administration, irrespective of what party they're in. I'm one of those, like Senator Vandenberg of the middle of the last century, who said that politics should end at the water's edge. I'm a firm believer in that. I think America needs to maintain a strong internationalist foreign policy. When we try to retreat into ourselves, we expose ourselves to greater danger. That doesn't mean I think we should be fighting hopeless wars and doing nation building all over the place. You know, I have a much more realist view than I think prevailed in the Republican Party early in this century, but I'm still remaining engaged, certainly.
Matt, your life and career has taken you from Boston to Beijing to Baghdad and Kabul and from DC and now to Utah. I might say the past few years were a bit discombobulating for Friends of America. And during that period, it was quite comforting to look over to Washington, D.C. and see that someone of your patriotism and public spiritedness was working at the White House. So thank you for that, Matt Pottinger. And thank you for joining me today on the Director's Chair.
Hey, great. Thanks so much, Michael. Thanks for all the work that you and Loey has done, all the writing and the close eye to history. You've written a lot of great history, and you've approached the world with the eye of a historian. And we've all benefited from that. So thanks so much for staying in touch over the years that I was in the White House.
Thanks, Matt. And I hope to see you in person soon.
You too.
You've been listening to The Director's Chair, a podcast by the Loey Institute, hosted by me, Michael Fullilove. Thanks for listening, and please tune in to the next episode of The Director's Chair.